Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Our features this morning cover reports from Lane County in Oregon and the Washington Legislature. We have an update from Leah Moriarty on the U.S. Forest Service plan to mitigate next year's wildfires with salvage logging, replanting, and hazardous tree removal. We begin this morning with an update to a shipping accident that occurred last week on the Columbia River. More details emerged this week about the grounding of the grain freighter Sparna last week near Kathlamet, but it will be weeks, if not months, before authorities finish investigating the incident, according to the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is interviewing crew members of both vessels and is reconstructing the movements of the vessels using satellite and ground-based tracking devices. The Sparna, a 623-foot Panamanian flag vessel, went aground outside Columbia River shipping lanes near the paper mill at Wana while it was attempting to leave the Columbia River. An inbound vessel was passing the Sparna in the opposite direction at the time of the mishap, according to Lieutenant Commander John Titchen of Coast Guard Station Warrenton. The ship channel is 600 feet wide and 43 feet deep, making it a tight fit for large vessels, especially those loaded to capacity, to navigate safely. All 10 people on the bridge of the Sparna, including the Columbia River pilot, were subject to routine blood alcohol testing. Commander Titchen declined to say whether the investigation at this point indicated mechanical or human error, and the agency will not release many details of the probe until it's finished. The Sparna briefly ran aground at 12:16 a.m. Monday the 21st, fully loaded with grain in its cargo hold and carrying over 200,000 gallons of high-sulfur fuel and 39,000 gallons of marine diesel. According to the Coast Guard, the ship has a 25-foot-long gash that's 5 feet wide in its hull with a boulder lodged inside. The damage is to a void space, which is normally empty. According to the Coast Guard, no fuel spilled from the ship. The grounding occurred near one of the most ecologically sensitive parts of the Columbia River, in the vicinity of the Columbian White-tailed Deer Refuge and the Lewis and Clark Wildlife Refuge, an archipelago of islands in the lower river. Titchen credited cooperation between the Coast Guard and state agencies from Oregon and Washington with ensuring the boat was towed safely to Kalama by tugboats. The Sparna is undergoing repairs at Kalama that could take several weeks. In another development on this story, authorities this week captured a crew member who was reported AWOL Saturday morning by the captain of the Sparna. Mark Kim, an agent for the Department of Homeland Security, said a Bangladeshi national was captured in Montana. It was not immediately clear why he fled or whether he was held in custody or returned to his vessel. Now, if you're worried that your lifestyle isn't healthy enough, you're not alone. Only 2.7% of adults have all four healthy characteristics measured in a new study by Oregon State University researchers. This means fewer than 3% of adults in the study were non-smokers, performed moderate exercise, ate a good diet, and had normal body fat percentages. For the study, moderate exercise was considered 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity each week, and a good diet was defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's dietary guidelines. Karen Girard is with the Oregon Health Authority. She says people can get their health on track by doing simple things like riding their bikes to work or walking to the park with the family.
Those are the really important ways that we can incorporate it into our regular lives, so it is not something that we have to do in addition to all of the other parts of our very busy lives.
Girard is concerned some communities don't offer the components to support more active lifestyles. For example, some places don't have sidewalks so that a family could walk to their local park safely. And when they do walk to their park, it might not be properly lit, lowering the chances for a healthy outing even further.
What can we do together to make sure that those settings are supportive of health so that people can get the physical activity, eat healthfully, and avoid tobacco to live healthy, active lives?
Researchers interviewed and used devices such as accelerometers to measure more than 4,500 participants. The study found about 16% had three of the healthy characteristics, 37% had two, 34% had one, and 11% had none of the four. Oregon State University was aided by researchers at the University of Tennessee Chattanooga and the University of Mississippi. Oregon's water is tested for suspended solids, certain chemicals, heavy metals, but not for pharmaceuticals. With prescription drug use on the rise, unused meds end up in the landfill or flushed down the toilet. Tiffany Eckert reports on how Lane County agencies are stepping up their message of what to do with unwanted drugs.
Sarah Grimm is the waste reduction specialist for Lane County Public Works. She's seeing a problem in her industry, pharmaceutical meds being flushed down the toilet.
I continue to get reports from citizens who've heard from either a pharmacy or a healthcare provider telling them, oh, well, if they don't work for you, just flush them.
Even the Drug Enforcement Agency's website continues to advise flushing some powerful meds down the toilet to keep them out of the wrong hands.
Reports from the environmental water quality side, we're increasingly noticing that pharmaceutical substances were showing up in the waterways.
Dr. Sam Chan is a professor at Oregon State University and a watershed specialist. He's been a part of numerous studies on the impact of drugs like pain relievers and antibiotics in our water. Chan describes what happened when mood-altering drugs such as Prozac were present in waterways.
The fish became, I hate to use the word happy, but became less concerned about being in the open where they could be eaten by other fish, mainly because the compounds of the antidepressants had altered their mood and made them less afraid.
Dr. Chan worked on a Puget Sound study published last month. The results found juvenile salmon have a creepy compound of drugs in their tissue.
I'm concerned. Based on the evidence that we see of increasing amounts of unused pharmaceuticals in the water, the fact that there's so many of them occurring in mixtures.
Municipal water systems are cyclical. Water's taken out of source, distributed for use, and then treated and pumped back into a river downstream. For over 200,000 Eugene Springfield residents, their drinking water source starts here. The McKinsey River headwaters. Nancy Toth is an environmental specialist with Eugene Water and Electric Board. She's read plenty about how aquatic life is affected by pharmaceuticals in water, but she and her colleagues can only wonder how people are impacted.
There aren't any studies that look at the long-term effects of low levels of various combinations of pharmaceuticals on human health. It is very expensive to monitor for these pharmaceuticals, and it is not required.
That's right, it's not required. Toth says when large-scale testing is done, they do find traces of drugs in waterways. She recalls a U.S. Geological Survey study.
They found chemicals or pharmaceuticals in over 80% of the streams and rivers that they tested.
Toth says Eugene Springfield residents are doubly lucky. First, there's the excellent water source quality.
And we're lucky to not be downstream of any large wastewater treatment plants.
But tens of thousands of Oregonians are. Once McKinsey water and anything that's put in it goes down the drain or toilet, it's gathered as black water at the Metropolitan Wastewater Facility in West Eugene. Every day, 25 million gallons of wastewater pass through a series of pipes and tanks. First, solid materials are separated out. They call them the three P's.
We get poo, pee, paper.
Michelle Miranda is a supervisor with Eugene's Wastewater Division. She knows pharmaceutical starts with a P too, but it is not on the list of what can be flushed. She says wastewater managers all over the region have shared their concern about the issue for years.
We've detected low levels of these substances through the water bodies. It's okay, what does that mean now?
The message is the same from water, waste, and environmental agencies. Coordinated drug disposal is the best way to keep meds out of waterways. Miranda wants to be clear. When pharmaceuticals have been found in water, they're at low levels, nanograms, not micrograms. Not enough to panic? Well, how much of someone else's medicine is acceptable in your drinking water? Down a hallway at the Lane County Sheriff's Office in downtown Eugene stands a green metal box with the message, "Deposit your unwanted prescription drugs here."
This box gets filled up weekly.
Carrie Sung is an evidence technician with the department. Sung says this confidential drug take-back program can be a comfort for people who've lost someone.
When people come in, they usually tell us, we've got some serious medications because, you know, the person was on hospice and it's all right, you know, we can help them with that.
In late 2014, the DEA relaxed rules on where these boxes can be. Now pharmacies are allowed to operate them. For the time being, law enforcement officers like Carrie Sung hope unused pharmaceuticals, controlled substances, over-the-counter drugs, even veterinary meds will find their way to existing drop boxes.
The reason we have it is to keep the pills and the medications out of the wrong people's hands, out of the waterways.
Waste and water managers work in conjunction with public health and law enforcement to create and maintain these safe drug disposal sites. They implore us to use them because they don't want their hard work to go down the toilet either. Tiffany Eckert reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge. Now, if you're lucky enough to own your own forest, this just might interest you. Private landowners in Northwest Oregon can apply to receive a free assessment of their forest land from the Natural Resource Conservation Service, or NRCS, a division of the United States Department of Agriculture. The free assessment includes the gauging of the health of the forest land and the value of a carbon crediting program for landowners. Dean Moberg is a conservationist for the NRCS. He says the most important aspect of the program is developing a plan for forest management.
And then also doing a really precise inventory of the amount of carbon that's stored in the trees out there now and the extra carbon that might be stored if the forest owners adapted their management in certain ways.
Private non-commercial landowners have until April 15th to apply for a free assessment. The NRCS is partnering with the Pinchot Institute for Conservation to help provide landowners with information on carbon crediting programs. This is the second year of a five-year project, which has nearly $2 million of funding at its disposal. During this year's session, Oregon legislators did not consider a bill that would have created a carbon cap-and-trade program in the state. However, Brian Kittler of the Pinchot Institute says that doesn't necessarily mean Oregonians can't profit from the cap-and-trade program in California.
It is a steady market. There is some real dollars there. And if it fits within their long-term objectives of owning and managing their land, then it's a viable option for them to consider.
Assessments are available for landowners in Columbia, Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. The special 30-day session of the Washington legislature may be over by the time you hear this. Election year partisan tensions have been on display since lawmakers convened in January. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins takes a look at what's passed, what failed, and what dominated in the 2016 regular session.
Back in January, Seattle's Ballard High School Concert Choir performed the national anthem for the governor's State of the State address. It was a brief moment of harmony in a legislative session marked by moments of sharp partisanship. The sharpest of those moments arguably came a month later. That's when majority Republicans in the state Senate decided not to confirm Secretary of Transportation Lynn Peterson. She'd been appointed 3 years earlier by Democratic Governor Jay Inslee.
This is a very, very serious decision.
Senate Budget Chair Andy Hill was the first to make the case for firing Peterson.
But I have no confidence that the agency is in a position to fix the problems they have without a change at the top.
It marked the first time in 20 years the state Senate had voted not to confirm a gubernatorial appointment. The following Monday, Governor Inslee held an angry news conference.
Senate Republicans should be ashamed of what they did last Friday.
Relations between the Democratic governor, who's up for re-election, and Senate Republicans did not improve as the session wore on.
All right, we'll go ahead and call the meeting of the
Senate Law and Justice Committee issued subpoenas and held a series of hearings on the accidental early release of nearly 3,000 prison inmates over a 13-year period. Once again, Republicans zeroed in on whether Inslee was doing enough to hold his agency heads accountable. But even as partisan tensions simmered and sometimes flared, the business of the legislature continued. The first bill signed by Inslee was a bipartisan pledge by lawmakers to take action next year to end the dependence on local school levies to fund public schools. The state has until 2018 to fully fund basic education by order of the Washington Supreme Court. Lawmakers also voted to try to resurrect voter-approved charter schools after the Supreme Court ruled them unconstitutional. This was a top priority of Republicans like Senate Majority Leader Mark Schessler.
If you sat through those hearings and listened to the teachers, students, the parents, I don't know how you could find it in your heart to vote against it.
But many Democrats did vote no on the belief that charter schools lack accountability and siphon resources from public schools.
Now, this isn't about kids.
State Representative Mike Sells was booed when he suggested on the House floor that moneyed special interests are behind charters.
What this is about were those 22 high-priced lobbyists out there the last few days.
Police accountability was another theme during the 2016 Washington legislative session. Lawmakers voted to create a task force to examine police use of deadly force, and they approved a hotly debated police body camera measure. If more than 250 bills passed, hundreds more fell short. They include a state Voting Rights Act backed by Democrats and a bipartisan push to regulate e-cigarettes. Some of the biggest crowds of the session turned out for hearings on what some Republicans took to calling the
bathroom bill.
This was a Republican-led effort to repeal a new state rule that says transgender people can access the restroom or locker room of their choice. The repeal effort made it all the way to the floor of the state Senate, where it was voted down. Just before the regular session adjourned, an effort to find a bit of harmony again as Lieutenant Governor Brad Owen led a bipartisan rendition of Hallelujah in the Capitol Rotunda. That performance was also what you might call the Lieutenant Governor's swan song. Owen is not running for re-election after 5 terms in office. In his goodbye speech, the Democrats spoke of the insanity of partisan politics and warned of D.C.-style gridlock. A few days later, he gaveled lawmakers back into special session because they couldn't agree on the budget. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
After weeks of gridlock, the Washington House and Senate did reach a budget deal. Lawmakers plan quickly to vote to update the state's 2-year spending plan.
The prosecution's narrative is that Kelly illegally withheld millions of dollars in homeowner fees and then, when lawsuits were filed in 2008, sought to hide the money by rapidly moving it through a series of bank transfers. The defense is trying to convince the jury that what might look like the acts of a guilty man were actually the reasonable actions of a businessman. For instance, those bank transfers, the defense suggests that was perfectly legal asset protection, not concealing the proceeds of a crime.
Our thanks to Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins for his report. During the summer of 2014, wildfires burned more than 200,000 acres of the Klamath National Forest in Northern California's Siskiyou County. Last year, the U.S. Forest Service proposed a program of salvage logging, replanting, and hazardous tree removal. That plan faced opposition from environmental groups and the Karuk Indian tribe. Now a modified version of the plan has been approved and was immediately met with a challenge in federal court. From Jefferson Public Radio, Liam Moriarty has this update.
Klamath National Forest Supervisor Patricia Grantham says the decision to proceed with the plan comes after months of meticulous study and consideration of a wide range of viewpoints, from
treat everything, salvage harvest everything, to do very little. So there was a whole spectrum of restoration actions at our doorstep.
The plan calls for removing the remaining trees from more than 5,500 acres of severely burned forest, most of it on steep slopes. It would cut down hazard trees along 320 miles of road, as well as plant nearly 13,000 acres of new tree seedlings and perform more than 24,000 acres of so-called hazardous fuel reduction. That includes cutting fire breaks along ridgetops and near homes and other structures. Patricia Grantham says it's important to clear away the burned trees to prevent future fires.
Within 20 or 25 years, those standing dead trees, they fall down, brush comes through them, and you just end up with this continuous fuel bed that when you get the next fire in there, it just ends up with a footprint of even larger high severity fire.
But George Sexton, with the conservation group KS Wild, says recent studies show removing burned trees and planting seedlings is exactly the wrong way to limit future fires.
When you clear cut and bring all those fuels down to the surface of the forest and you plant a dense young plantation, those stands tend to reburn at a higher severity than stands that are not salvage logged.
A better long-term fire strategy, Sexton says,
is to focus your logging activities near homes and communities that you want to protect, on ridge lines that you want to use to bifurcate watersheds, and then to use periodic prescribed fire to try and get fire back into those ecosystems on your own terms.
Sexton notes that salvage logging is planned in areas that have been restricted under the Northwest Forest Plan for spotted owl habitat. The fact that those acres have burned, he says, shouldn't remove that protection. Craig Tucker with the Karuk tribe says clear-cutting fire-killed trees on steep slopes with unstable soil will hurt threatened salmon in the streams below.
And so we do have to leave some of those burned trees in these deep river canyons that hold the surface together. We just cannot afford to bury these spawning beds again by allowing them to go in there and clear-cut the forest.
The lawsuit, filed by the Karuk and several conservation groups, including KS Wild, focuses largely on the alleged impacts to salmon and other protected wildlife. Tucker says the tribe's proposed alternative to the Forest Service plan would result in less risk to salmon and better long-term fire recovery.
You know, Karuk's been here for a long time, and what people may not realize is for thousands of years, people here use fire on a watershed scale to manage this landscape.
The delay that could be caused by the legal challenge is worrisome to Ann Forrest Burns. She's with the American Forest Resource Council, a Portland-based industry group. Burns notes the longer killed trees stay in the forest, the more likely they are to decay and lose their market value.
A year is optimal for salvage harvest, and we're well beyond that now.
Burns says these salvage timber sales are important to the timber company she represents.
They built their mills on the strength of the availability of timber from public land. And when the public land is not managed, it's not treated appropriately, that diminishes the horizon for their children and their grandchildren and for the children and grandchildren of their employees.
The Forest Service has begun auctioning off salvaged timber units. George Sexton says if the Forest Service doesn't agree to changes in the plan, the plaintiffs will seek an injunction to stop those sales from proceeding. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
That's all the time we have for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of the show or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We like hearing from you. Send your questions and comments to News 1, that's NEWS and the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. And you can like us on Facebook. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.